Tess Vigeland here from the Wall Street Journal's As We Work podcast. This season, we'll take you from that first job all the way to retirement and all the career moments along the way. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is your tech news briefing for Friday, June 3rd. I'm Zoe Thomas for the Wall Street Journal. Today, we wrap up our special series on how private space companies are reshaping the way we think about and work in space. We've talked about the new jobs that could be created as we spend more time up there.
We're going to need not scientists to go into space anymore and you know, grow chili peppers on the International Space Station, but we need workers that can go into space for extended durations.
We've discussed how hard it is to agree on rules that everyone in space will follow.
We don't control space at NASA or even in the United States, but we do want to maintain our interests and make sure that we have freedom of operation.
Today, we look at one of the biggest threats to the growing space sector. The tens of thousands of pieces of old satellites, rocket parts, and broken spacecraft floating around uncontrollably in low Earth orbit. All of our space junk.
You know, humans and even the services that we depend upon, any number of these things can get schwacked by one of these pieces of junk.
But what's being done about it? On today's show, we'll dig into some of the solutions being tested and the obstacles they face. That's after the break.
In growing companies, there are two kinds of CFOs, the ones overwhelmed with manual processes, errors, and lack of control of the numbers, and the one who uses NetSuite by Oracle, the number one cloud financial system, with visibility and control of financials, inventory, HR, planning, and budgeting. NetSuite is everything you need to grow all in one place. The CFOs that get it, get it. The CFOs that don't, don't. Head to netsuite.com/wallstreet for a special one-of-a-kind financing offer. netsuite.com/wallstreet.
Last year, the world got a wake-up call about the dangers of space junk.
Tonight, high drama aboard the International Space Station.
The State Department is calling a Russian missile test in space reckless and irresponsible. That missile targeted an old Russian satellite producing debris that threatens Americans and others on board the International Space Station.
Seven astronauts had to scramble to their safety capsules after Russia blew up one of its own satellites with an Earth-based missile.
Okay, here's what happened. Russia shot a missile into space last November. It was testing its anti-satellite technology to see if it could destroy or incapacitate one of its own orbiting satellites. Turns out, it could. The U.S. State Department says that missile smashed the Russian spacecraft into 1,500 large pieces and hundreds of thousands of smaller fragments, which resulted in a dangerous cloud of debris, and it forced the crew aboard the ISS to take shelter in their escape pods, SpaceX's Dragon capsule.
We were recently informed of a satellite breakup and need to have you guys start reviewing the safe haven procedure.
The crew and NASA's mission control even discussed getting them off the ISS entirely.
If Dragon takes a hit, we will get you back on station.
In the end, the debris passed close to the ISS, but didn't hit it. The crew was fine. But the incident highlighted just how big of a problem space debris can be. In mid-April, Vice President Kamala Harris said the U.S. would not conduct tests like this and called on other countries to do the same. But that promise won't reduce the space junk already out there, and missile tests are just one way that space debris is created. Sometimes used rockets and old satellites are intentionally left up there. And the more of it that's floating around, the harder it will be to avoid.
The Space Force currently tracks more than 40,000 objects in space, only about 5,000 of which are active satellites.
That's General David Thompson from Space Force in a video from last year announcing the military branch's project called Orbital Prime, One of the goals of the program is to find ways to reduce space junk.
Those 40,000 objects are about the size of one's fist or larger. But conservative estimates say there are at least 10 times as many smaller objects in orbit that we cannot reliably track. And yet, those smaller bits of debris pose as much or greater risk to our satellites as the larger pieces.
Okay, cheesy music aside, the problem is significant. According to research from NASA, a piece of debris the size of a softball could destroy a satellite on impact. Something the size of a marble could damage a spacecraft. And it would only take a piece of space junk the size of a grain of salt to puncture a spacesuit. So basically, in a worst-case scenario, experts warn that uncontrolled debris could make it impossible to safely work or live in orbit. And the problem of space junk has become more acute. NASA says in 2012 there were just 45 global space launches. By comparison, the FAA recorded 54 licensed launches from the U.S. alone last year. That means more space debris, but also potential business opportunities for companies that are trying to show they can clean it up. So, how will they do that? Well, first they need to know where all the space junk is. It may seem like an impossible task. After all, space is vast, right? But actually, most of the satellites are in the same general area, and that area is getting crowded.
At least in the United States, we have interstates that connect things and that sort of stuff. People just don't drive just anywhere. Even on the oceans, we take advantage of ocean currents because we don't like fighting Mother Nature. Fighting Mother Nature to get from point A to point B is a losing proposition.
That's Maura Bajwa. He's the chief scientist and co-founder of the venture capital-backed startup Privateer. It's one of the many companies trying to tackle this problem, along with governments across the globe.
And then, even in the air, we have certain airways, and we also take advantage of air currents and these sorts of stuff and avoid bad weather. So near-Earth outer space is very equivalent. You know, we have places, thanks to Mother Nature, curvature of space-time, where if we want a satellite to provide a very specific service, there's almost this Goldilocks. This is the just right to put the satellite where we don't have to fight Mother Nature and we can, you know, achieve these services and capabilities.
For many satellites to be useful, they have to orbit the Earth at just the right distance. Some can be farther away from the planet, but a growing number of satellites providing internet and taking pictures are being sent to low Earth orbit. But according to Jha, there isn't a central database for all those satellites, or all the space junk that gets left when they are decommissioned.
The U.S. has its government sensors, China its own, Russia its own, so on and so forth. The thing that's missing is bringing all this stuff together.
That's what Privateer aims to do. It's working on what it calls the Google Maps of space, an easily accessible, digitized map of everything in those Goldilocks zones. The idea is to build a holistic picture of where all those moving objects in orbit are at any given moment, from decommissioned satellites to old rocket parts and even those small bits of debris like we discussed earlier. Other companies are also tracking objects in low Earth orbit. Lockheed Martin has what it calls the Space Fence Radar that it developed with the U.S. Space Force. And there's the French startup ShareMySpace, which developed a collision warning system for objects in space. But tracking data in space isn't easy, for Privateer or its competitors. Drawing a map of space is not like making a map on Earth. For one thing, houses and landmarks don't shift position. In space, everything moves.
It's dynamic because everything affecting space is changing, everything in space is changing. So it's a dynamic library that is, you can be looked at historically, because some people need to trace that for statistics and that sort of stuff, but can give you kind of a near real-time, you know, predictive picture of what's happening on orbit.
Jha thinks the information Privateer is gathering could be used by other private companies to do things like build applications, maybe ones that could predict future space traffic jams, or students could use it to study the development of low Earth orbit.
So Privateer makes money in a myriad of ways, not the least of which is saying, here's this foundational level of information that is just good for humanity to have regarding things like safety, security, and sustainability. But if you're some entity that is going to make a profit from this sort of thing, and you want something more bespoke, you want a more accurate prediction, something more near real time, more granularity on these sorts of things, then I think there's going to be a menu of ways to get that for a fee.
And of course, it could be used to help guide efforts at cleaning up all that space junk. That brings us to the second big challenge when it comes to cleaning up space. Once we know where all that debris is, how do we actually go about collecting it? One Tokyo-based company working on a solution is Astroscale. Its roughly 250 employees are working to not just remove debris, they also want to make it easier to collect satellites so they can be repaired in space, which would mean less junk in the first place. The company's been trying to tackle this problem for almost a decade. Here's Astroscale's chief operating officer, Chris Blackerby.
We need people to focus on the long term, even if it's not the risk or the possibility is not right in front of their faces.
But how do you collect old tech floating in space? At least debris that's big enough to grab. The solution Astroscale landed on? Magnets. Last year, Astroscale ran a test of its system. It set up two satellites, one to act as the junk collector and the other as dummy debris.
We successfully released that small piece of dummy debris, very short distance, and then moved the larger servicing satellite in to capture it. On the piece of dummy debris is a plate with ferromagnetic material. And on the larger servicing satellite, there's a robotic arm that extends out that has a magnets on it, and it would attach to it. So using onboard sensors and that magnetic capture capability, we grabbed on to that smaller piece of dummy debris. So we're testing out the technologies to be able to find, rendezvous with, and grab onto a piece of debris in space.
After the first promising demonstration, Astroscale began working through some more challenging scenarios, testing out all sorts of variables, different speeds, distances from the junk collector, how fast the junk is rotating.
Basically, we're building up the capabilities and the technologies to capture a piece of debris that might not be stable in orbit. It might be having a tumble.
Astroscale says its collector and its fake junk are moving at around 7.5 kilometers, or about 4.7 miles, every second, about as fast as other debris in low Earth orbit. But it says tumbling rates are a big unknown factor for collecting space junk, adding another layer of difficulty to this process. The company says after multiple other tests, it's struggling to capture the dummy debris. But even if Astroscale's system were to work perfectly, capturing junk exactly as planned every time, it would still face another challenge. Both the junk collector and the equipment it's collecting need to be equipped with those special magnets. That would mean for its system to be adopted, Astroscale would need to have buy-in from companies that are sending up satellites and get them to attach those dinner plate-sized magnets before they're launched. And that's not an easy sell. Astroscale is asking companies to adopt an unproven technology that adds to their cost and, crucially, to their weight. And every gram counts when you're trying to get things into orbit. Blackerby says the extra weight would be good for everyone's business.
They can reduce the risk of any failed satellites that are in their orbits in the future. So there's nobody forcing them to do it right now. There's some companies that are taking the step to do it.
And for companies creating webs of satellites like broadband provider OneWeb and SpaceX, one failed satellite in a network could disrupt their operations. In May 2021, Astroscale was awarded around $3.2 million to partner with OneWeb in developing debris removal tech. OneWeb plans to put Astroscale's tech on future generations of its internet satellites. Astroscale also signed partnerships with space agencies in the UK, EU, and Japan to test its technology. And at the end of last year, the company announced it raised more than $100 million, its biggest funding round yet, bringing its total funding to $300 million. Other companies are also eyeing the market for space debris removal. A few years ago, for example, Airbus said it was testing out a method of using a harpoon and a net. Another company based in Japan says it wants to use laser beams to push junk out of the way of other objects. The European Space Agency says it's been testing out giant fishing nets to catch debris. And it's partnering with a Swiss startup developing a system that would grab inactive ESA objects in space using four robotic arms. Some suggestions for debris removal are as simple as adding a handle so that debris could be collected by a space garbage collector. Yes, space garbage collector. Yet another space job. Other ideas are just to shove the space debris out of the way, moving it from those Goldilocks orbital pathways to places known as orbital junkyards, areas that aren't as usable and, as a result, have less traffic. Some countries have started requiring companies to design satellites in ways that make cleanup easier later on, but the regulations aren't universal. According to space market research group Northern Sky Research, annual revenue from active debris removal, that's companies collecting space junk, is estimated to reach $9 million by 2030. That's not a lot. And NSR forecasts that while almost 180 satellites could be removed, only about 1 in 6 will actually get taken care of. They say the operators of the rest won't want to pay for the services. Something Astroscale's Chris Blackerby understands. What does it mean for your business model, though, to be making the argument to people like, spend money now on something that isn't totally developed that you don't have to do?
It's tough. It's tough. But what I'm heartened to see, though, Zoe, is that it's changing. I see that there is a real sea change in understanding of the issue and a recognition that things have to be done.
As more companies enter the private space industry, the big challenge for these kinds of cleanup technologies will be how to reach mass adoption. Morba Jha from Privateer says he's been making an argument for space environmentalism for a long time, and he hears the rumbles of change.
Basically, I was like Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill kind of thing. And, you know, I think now is a great time because there seems to be kind of a critical mass of will across different spacefaring countries. So it's almost like this is the time of the next renaissance. That's the way it feels.
That's the way it feels to many people in this industry. They see a huge potential to start new businesses and make a lot of money. For the rest of us, that could mean a future where traveling, working, and living in space are all within reach. And that does it for this special series of Tech News Briefing. Thanks for joining us on this journey through space. This episode was written and reported by myself and producer Julie Chang. Jess Fenton is our sound engineer. We had editorial support from Micah Maidenberg and David Freeman. Our supervising producer is Chris Zinsley. Our executive producer is Kateri Yoakum. And I'm your host, Zoe Thomas, for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening. And you can listen to the full series on our website, WSJ.com.
Tess Vigeland here from the Wall Street Journal's As We Work podcast. This season, we'll take you from that first job all the way to retirement and all the career moments along the way. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.